Pastor Sundell, I looked it up. The difference between you and me is 10,460 days. That's amazing, isn't it? So you have been alive, if I got your information right, 31,954. That's pretty good. He's still ministering, still strong, still being used by God. That's great. Normally, we would have been looking at Revelation chapter 3. We're going through the seven churches of Revelation, and we would have been looking at the church of Thyatira. The problem is that the church of Thyatira was a little bit too immoral for a G-rated sermon on the day when all the kids are here. And so we are going to do the G-rated sermon, and we're going to talk about Solomon asking for wisdom, a little bit more appropriate for the kids. On the first Sunday of the month, we always have the kids in here with us, and if Bonnie doesn't remind me, usually we get R-rated sermons. The Bible says that Solomon, the child of Bathsheba and David, interestingly enough, you know, remember, there's some background there, and you wouldn't expect that God would prefer the byproduct of that kind of difficult relationship. But he had been hand-selected by the king and by God to succeed him. As King David was dying, he had called Solomon in and given him a list of things to do right away so that there would be no interruption in the transition between King David and King Solomon. He wanted it to go smoothly, and so he said, "You follow my instructions and it will go smoothly." And Solomon did everything just as his father had said, and so now the kingdom was his. David had expanded the territory and influence of Israel by means of war. There had been war after war after war. In fact, it was to the point where David wanted to begin construction on the temple, on the house of God there in Jerusalem. And God said, "Nope, you can gather the materials, you can do the planning or write down what I tell you to do, but you cannot build it because there's too much blood on your hands. You have been a man of war, and I want your son, who is going to be a man of peace." Solomon's name would have been Shlomo. And Shlomo, Shalom, is peace. And so peace was built right into his name. So David had expanded the kingdom and increased its wealth, but through war. Solomon will come in, and he will expand it even further and become amazingly wealthy, but he will do it in a time of peace. And so now that the kingdom was secured, it was in his hands, it would be up to Solomon to maintain what his father had given him and passed on to him, even to expand it. But he knew he was young, he was humble, and he was afraid. He was happy to be king, but he knew that he was in way over his head. And I've just got to tell you, there's another sermon that I do from time to time that deals with how you know that God has called you to do something. And one of the ways you can tell that God is in this opportunity or not is when there's an opportunity that comes and you feel like it might be the Lord's will and you look at it and say, "Oh, that's impossible." 9 times out of 10, that's what God wants you to do. He often will put you into a position and require you to do the impossible, but he does it through you, and then he glorifies himself. But that's another sermon. The kingdom, the Bible says, was now firmly established in Solomon's hands. Last verse of 1 Kings chapter 2. Now in 1 Kings chapter 3, verse 1, Solomon made an alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and married his daughter. He brought her to the city of David, that's Jerusalem, until he finished building his palace and the temple of the Lord and the wall around Jerusalem. So right away, he's got these three really big construction projects on his plate. The people, however, were still sacrificing at the high places because the temple had not yet been built for the name of the Lord. Solomon showed his love for the Lord by walking according to the statutes, the rules of his father David, except that he offered sacrifices and burned incense on the high places. Now, it was good that Solomon wanted to please God. Unfortunately, he did not do it precisely, perfectly, the way God wanted. The people, it says, were still sacrificing at the high places because the temple had not yet been completed. Now, when it says high places, we get the idea of being at the top of a hill, and many of them were, but it wasn't necessarily high. It was primarily the idea of a country shrine, or it may have been groves of trees. It may have been near a brook. There would have been an altar made there, and you could come and you could sacrifice. The bigger ones would be less shrine and more like altar. The smaller ones would have just been a little shrine, and you burn your incense and your sacrifice right there. It wasn't what God preferred. God had already given them a place to do these things. It was in the tent, in the tabernacle. It was all supposed to be centralized. The first one was at a place called Shiloh. They were supposed to go to Shiloh, and then later on, it was moved to Jerusalem. So there was a tent called the tabernacle there in Jerusalem where they were supposed to do their sacrifices. For some reason, however, Solomon decides to go 7 miles out of town to Gibeon. Nowadays, if you go to Jerusalem, Gibeon is the suburb. So it was very close, but for some reason, he decides to go to Gibeon, and there he wants to sacrifice to the Lord. And Solomon showed his love for the Lord by walking according to the statutes of his father David, except that he offered sacrifices and burned incense on the high places. So technically, this is a sin. Technically, it's not correct. Have you ever thought, though, about how God helps us and gives us help in helping us to succeed? I'm glad that God doesn't wait until we're doing everything perfectly to help us. This is a very interesting passage because it's at the beginning of a life and a beginning of a ministry where a king will minister to God's people and lead them and guide them. And even though it starts off with difficulty, remember David and Bathsheba, that was a difficulty. But God goes ahead and it says he loves Solomon. And from the very beginning, even though there's this cloud over his heritage, God accepts him. And now, even though he's making the mistake of not going to the text and looking through the Torah, the first 5 books of the Bible, where he would have learned that this is wrong, God still overlooks this technical situation. He decides that he's going to help this young man, and he's going to make him successful. But it's interesting that when God decides to make someone successful and to answer their prayers, oftentimes, in fact, most of the time, it's conditional. Let me just give you a story. First of all, Deuteronomy 28:12, the end of the life of Moses, he's just about ready to die. He pulls the leaders together and he says, look, the Lord will open the heavens, the storehouse of his bounty, to send rain on your land in season and to bless all the work of your hands. You will lend to many nations, but will borrow from none. However, this is conditional on their willingness to follow him and do things the way that he wants to. It was 1988, and as I mentioned before, Bonnie and I were living with our daughters outside of Naperville, and we're ministering at a very large church there as a staff minister. And it had been an extremely dry season, an extremely dry summer. In fact, it was now a little bit past the middle of summer. The corn should have been ready to harvest. But quite frankly, it had burned up in so many places downstate. And it also had not achieved the height nor the maturity that was necessary for them to even be able to harvest it. In the best situations, it was almost there. But they needed a break in this horrible infernal heat and in this horrible drought. And so our senior pastor, who had been raised on a farm and was very sensitive to the farmers who were still in our community, called a special prayer meeting. And this was a church of several thousand people. We had five services on Sunday, three Sunday morning, two Sunday evening. And he said, on Monday night, we're going to come together and we're going to pray. We're going to pray for rain. And if we need to, we're going to pray Tuesday night. And if we need to, we're going to pray Wednesday night. We're going to pray Thursday night until we get a breakthrough. And so there were thousands of people who came together on Monday night. And we just sang a few songs, and then we got down and we began to pray and call out to the Lord. While we were praying, all of a sudden we heard a crack of thunder. Now, we had not had a drop of rain in well over 35 days, and there was none forecast. But all of a sudden, there was a crack of thunder. We looked up, saw a flash of lightning, and we heard a downpour of rain. And people just started rejoicing because it was absolutely a downpour. It was so solid. It was so strong. And we just thought, this is great. Until we all went home and looked at the Weather Channel, and they told us it just rained over Naperville. It was just a big circle over Naperville. And we're like, well, rats, we're going to have to do this again. And he didn't have a way of getting the word out. And so we had regular Wednesday service. And he says, tonight we're going to pray. And then we prayed on Thursday night. And finally, on Thursday night, it broke loose again all over the state. It came out of nowhere. It was a clear blue sky, and then suddenly clouds moved in during the prayer service and began to rain on the entire state. And that broke the drought. It saved that year's crops. My point is that if we seek God, if we try to please Him, He sees our sincerity and He responds to it. There's no reason why we have to think that we are victims of the weather. When He gives us the opportunity through prayer to accomplish His will, we can't change the weather, but He can. There's no reason why we should feel like we're victims of the economy when He gives us a way to change the world around us, including the economy. Do you realize that if you're pleasing the Lord, if you're calling out to Him, then you have a right to expect that He is going to take care of you, even though your neighbors may be tanking, even though people who don't know God may really go through a time of suffering. And during times when Christians go through suffering, God is always there to hear our prayers. So God, in His kindness and love, overlooked the sin of King Solomon and gave him a break. Isn't that amazing? He overlooked the sin. Now, this does not mean that there wasn't a sin. A sin is a sin. The sin was still there. This doesn't mean that the sin didn't have to be paid for. It definitely had to be paid for. But what it meant was that God decided not to hold it against them. We have a precedent in the New Testament for this as well. In Jesus dealing with the Pharisees in Mark chapter 10, some Pharisees came and tested Jesus by saying, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife?" "What did Moses command you?" he replied. They said, "Well, Moses permitted a man to write a certificate of divorce and to send her away." And if I understand it correctly, the phraseology of this, according to the rabbis, was, if a woman fails to find favor in the eyes of her husband for anything. Now, this means if he got burnt toast, he'd give her a warning. If she did it again, that's it. That's kind of rough. She couldn't divorce him, but he could divorce her. This is what their law said. This is what Moses had given them. It's a little stiff, isn't it? Then he could go out and marry someone else, according to the rabbi. She couldn't. She'd have to go back and live with her parents again, or else become a beggar or somebody else that wasn't in a good situation. He says, what did Moses command you? They said, well, Moses permitted a man to give her a certificate of divorce and send her away. Jesus says, it was because your hearts were hard that Moses wrote you this law. But at the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife. The two will become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one. Therefore, what God has joined together, let man not separate. He says, listen to me. He says, since we're talking about Moses, let me tell you what was behind the scenes. And he pulls back the curtain. And we get to see in the judge's room of heaven. And we get to see what was in God's mind when he allowed this change. God says, there's one man and one woman. And God has determined who's supposed to be married to whom. Now, I think that I was created so that Bonnie could have a project. She's 9 months older than me. Now, you wouldn't know that because when Bonnie and April and Amy, my two daughters, when April's here from Costa Rica and we say, let's go and we'll take you guys out to eat, we show up, and I've had this happen more than once. The guy looks at me and these three beautiful ladies and he says, oh, daddy-daughter date tonight. And I know it's coming and I try to restrain myself, but 9 times out of 10, it's no tip for you. No tip. No, this is my wife. These are my daughters. So she's actually older than me. And so I think that God created her, realized how industrious she was, realized how intelligent she was, realized how nice she was, and also realized that you are not going to be happy unless you have a really tough project. And so I'm going to create an autochthonous hanyak for you. All of your life long, you are going to try to civilize this uncivilized Indian guy, this uncivilized rowdy guy. He will test your patience. He will test your love. He will test everything about your life. But if you are faithful, I will give you authority over him. Probably. And so I am so pleased. I honestly do believe that the way the Lord brought us together, it was supposed to be her. I knew it immediately. This is it. This is the one. It took me a year to get her attention. But since I got it, I've never been without it. And that makes a good life. This is the way God intended it. One man, one woman. And guess what? God did not have a plan for us to stop with one and go with another. Now, that does happen. And I think that as a church, we've got to realize that that does happen. We got to help people through it. We have to be there not to cast stones at people, especially when something happens before they know Christ. But, you know, as Christians, we need to do what God says. And God says, yeah, Moses allowed it because of the hardness of your hearts. We should not have hard hearts. The law of Moses does not apply to us because it's the law of Jesus Christ that we celebrate. And I believe that God gives you the person that he gives you to be the sandpaper in your life. You talk about rounding out the rough edges. Well, you know, sandpaper comes in different grit levels. You may be hoping for a 60 and you may get an 80. It just means more sanding. And you know what? That's part of God's plan. God brings people together because he wants to make something beautiful, the one beautiful thing out of two imperfect and incomplete things. That's what he wants. Together, you will produce offspring for Christ. That's what he loves. And he loves seeing you learn about him in the process. So here's Solomon. He's married this girl from Egypt. God wants him to settle down and make children. Now, unfortunately, he ends up with a lot of wives. And that's one of the things that he told the kings. He told Samuel before. He says, these guys are going to come along. You want a king? Let me tell you about the king disease. The king disease says that they want to multiply horses and chariots, which is power. They're going to want to multiply gold. They want to become wealthy. And they're going to want to multiply wives. This whole thing of sexuality is going to become an imbalance for them. He says, that's going to be the king's sickness. And you need to be prepared. If you want a king, we'll give you a king, but this is what you're going to have to deal with. And that's, in fact, what happened. But it's interesting to note that despite all of these problems and all of these difficulties, God still accepts Solomon. He still accepts his offerings. He still accepts the imperfect. Just like the thing with Moses. He says, you know what? He allows you to do that. But it wasn't his plan. Wasn't his plan. We as Christians, I hope that as we follow Jesus Christ, we understand that the law of Jesus Christ trumps the law of Moses. I don't want to live under the law of Moses. Read the book of Galatians. It'll tell you why. There is a law, but that law ends in death. We want to follow the law of righteousness. Just because God overlooks it doesn't mean that it's not a sin, nor does it mean that the sin requires no payment. But all along, God knew he was going to have to pay all our debts or we would all end up in hell. He already knew that he would send Jesus to die for us. So just as in the time of Jesus, so also in the time of Solomon, God makes all kinds of provisions so that we can live to worship him. The king went to Gibeon. He went to this high place to offer sacrifices, for that was the most important high place around. And Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. At Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon during the night in a dream. And God said, ask whatever you want me to give you. It's true that Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings, but I don't think that the amount is what drew God's attention. I think that was important for us as humans to know that he really was serious about this. But I think in verse 3, we see what really attracted God. Solomon showed his love for the Lord by walking according to the statutes of his father. Later on, God tells the prophets, he says, listen, quit trampling my courts. Quit walking into my holy place bringing your offerings. Because quite frankly, I don't care about dead animals. I care about a broken and a contrite heart. And this is what Solomon had. God was willing to overlook his shortcomings. God was willing to overlook his weaknesses and his sins as long as his heart was tender toward God. And that's the way it is with us as well. You don't know all of the sins that you commit in a day, and neither do I. A past president of Princeton University says, a clear conscience is often the result of a faulty memory. Yeah, just because my conscience is clear doesn't mean it should be clear. It just means I can't remember my sins. I can remember everyone else's. And women, part of the deal that you are blessed or cursed with is a memory that does not quit. Bonnie can not only tell me what I said when I was 17, 18, 19, she can tell me where I was wrong and what I was wearing. It's amazing. It's amazing. I say, how can you remember that? How can you not remember that? It's the difference between men and women. And you know, as a man, I'm not able to say, well, stop that. That's not right. That's the way God made her. That's the way God made her. And I'm not supposed to get defensive about that. I'm supposed to say, wow, that's interesting. You can remember that. Maybe I should ask you before I sin. Maybe I should ask you before I just go out and do things willfully. Probably one of the worst sins I ever did was to buy a car without letting her know. That was a big sin. We won't go into that. But I can guarantee you, after a year, she still would not drive that thing. So we had to get rid of it, and then we had to go together and get the car that we could both be happy with. All right. I've lost my place. So here's the point. If you really want to get God's attention, love him. It's not important that you go do a bunch of things for him, because God doesn't need anything that we offer him. He doesn't need our gold. He doesn't need our time. He doesn't need our efforts. But you know what? If we offer those to him with a contrite, with a humble heart, then it becomes a wonderful gift that he craves and will accept. For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong on behalf of those whose heart is loyal to him. And so it's our actions that result from a tender heart that draws his attention, not the other way around. It's not our actions that get his attention. It's the state of our heart that produces those kinds of actions, the other way around. People with tender hearts are able to relate to the problems of others. This is an especially valuable trait for future doctors. Have you ever had a doctor who was a knucklehead? Don't raise your hands. But I remember going to a doctor with Bonnie. She had some arthritis. And man, I knew that she really suffered from this, and I could tell by looking at her knuckles, they were swollen. I knew that there was something wrong. And so went to this one rheumatologist, and this woman made me so mad I wanted to slap her. She was just like, well, there's nothing wrong with you. I'm like, who are you talking to? This is a woman of God with swollen knuckles. Can't you see? This woman was abrupt. She had no empathy whatsoever. And Bonnie just felt like, well, I can't believe it. Nobody believes me. And I said, listen, I believe you, and your main doctor believes you. Let's go find a real rheumatologist and get this thing resolved. But sometimes you get a doctor that's just no empathy whatsoever. So this doctor in Germany decides to train a 20-something medical school student to feel genuine empathy for senior citizens. Her name is Dr. Rachel Eckhart from Berlin. And she has invented something called the aged man suit, which weighs around 22 pounds and has been custom made to simulate the physical consequences of old age. When these budding young gerontologists come to her, she says, all right, here's what we're going to do today. You're going to be an old man. Here are some ear protectors that will stifle hearing so you can't quite hear what people are saying to you. Here are some yellow visor glasses that will blur your eyesight, making it hard to distinguish colors and to distinguish detail. Here are knee and elbow pads, which will stiffen your joints. Here's a Kevlar-style jacket vest, which presses uncomfortably against your chest. And here are padded gloves, so that you actually don't have the manual dexterity that you used to have. Now I think that if she just hit them in the knees with a baseball bat, it would be really close. She doesn't do that. But these students start to realize that getting older is not for sissies, and it makes a much better doctor. And that's the way we need to be. Jesus came down to earth. He wore the same kind of body that you now wear. God made sure that Jesus knew firsthand the things that we would suffer because he cared about us. And Solomon, at the beginning of his ministry, was also empathetic. He also was tenderhearted, and that's what drew God's attention. Solomon answered when God came in the dream and offered him this wonderful gift. Solomon answered, he says, I'll give you anything you want. What do you want? Solomon says, you have shown great kindness to your servant, my father David, because he was faithful to you and righteous and upright in heart. You have continued this greatness to him and have given him a son to sit on his throne this very day. Now, O Lord, my God, not my father's God, my God, you have made your servant king in place of my father David, but I am only a little child and do not know how to carry out my duties. That's a great leader right there. That's a great leader. You never want a leader who steps up to the plate and says, yeah, I have it all together. I have all the answers. Not in kingdom work. You want somebody who says, you know what, I will respond dutifully, but I honestly am going to have to really rely on the Lord. You know, there are some presidential candidates that stand out from others because of this very trait. Your servant is here among the people you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to count or to number. So give your servant a discerning heart to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong. For who is able to govern this great people of yours? The Lord was pleased that Solomon had asked for this. And so God said to him, since you have asked for this wisdom, and not for long life or wealth for yourself, nor have you asked for the death of your enemies, but for discernment in administering justice, I will do what you have asked, and I will give you a wise and discerning heart, so there will never have been anyone like you, nor will there ever be. Moreover, I will give you what you have not asked for, both riches and honor, so that in your lifetime you will have no equal among kings. And if you walk in my ways and obey my statutes and commands, as David your father did, I will also give you a long life. Then Solomon awoke and he realized it had been a dream. So what? Solomon had a great start because he was tenderhearted, he was humble. And this is what pleased the Lord. The Lord says, seek first my kingdom and its righteousness. All these other things will be added to you. Students, it could be that you might hit third grade or you might hit fourth grade, and all of a sudden you cannot understand the math that is being thrown at you. All you have to do as a child of God is to go to him and say, Lord, I am so frustrated because I cannot understand this. But you are the God of the universe. Will you grow my brain while I sleep? And you know what? He will do it for you. If you say, Lord, will you help me with this so that I can be a better Christian? He will do it. He will do it, what you want me to do. I can't do it on my own. That's what made Solomon so wise, his tender heart.